Young lads, and it was especially lads, all over the land, set out on literary adventures with the likes of Stephen Claghorn, the youthful hero of the sea-centered epic The Privateers of 76 by writer Ralph Paine, whose words transported readers from this side of the ocean to the other. We're told Stephen Claghorn was anxious to participate in the great historical adventure of his time. A resident of Old Salem, Massachusetts, he longed to join the fight for American independence, and indeed had already suffered a broken nose in a melee between British troops and local citizens months before the shot heard round the world was fired at Concord. Having grown up in a thriving blue water port, the boy yearned to ship out as a privateer, but his widowed mother was adamantly opposed, having previously lost her own husband in a battle off the Isles of Shoals. A gallant captain finally persuaded the widow to allow Stephen to join the crew of the Atlantic. After an initial success capturing a poorly outfitted ship, the Atlantic engaged in a firefight with a well-equipped opponent and ended up surrendering. Incarcerated aboard the victorious ship, Stephen and his shipmates were transferred to Old Mill Prison on arrival in Plymouth, England. Eventually, Stephen and his erstwhile schoolmaster executed an audacious escape, which, after further adventures, led to Stephen's commandeering a small skiff on the Plymouth beach, in which he attempted, unsuccessfully, to join a Dutch vessel heading out to sea. The tide and an offshore breeze slowly carried the lad even farther from the harbor, and he awoke the next day, enveloped in fog, hungry, parched, and adrift in the English Channel, in a disorienting miasma of mist. But it wasn't just Paine's words that painted elaborate pictures of this odyssey in the mind's eye. It was illustrations by master artists like Frank Schoonover who thrilled young readers. In this case, Frank Schoonover painted the desperate drama of an exhausted boy lost at sea, alone in a small boat, lacking provisions. Stephen sits dejectedly and morosely, hand on cheek, and stares emptily at the sea swells, contemplating his own imminent demise. In his present dire situation, he questioned the wisdom of having escaped. All that from the catalogue for an exhibition titled Selections from the Sordoni Collection of American Illustration and Comic Art, an exhibition opening tomorrow and running through May 20th at the Sordoni Art Gallery at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre. And we see a handsome photograph at the start of the catalogue of Andrew J. Sordoni III, once a young reader himself, at his desk with a painting on the wall of Stephen Claghorn, alone in his small boat, with the caption below the photo, Stephen's One Desire. As we've seen, such stories as Claghorn's and their illustrations stirred desires in young readers to set off on adventures at sea, medieval quests, crime-fighting sprees. But so few readers set out on actual quests to track down, preserve, and celebrate the images that brought them such joy. Andrew Sordoni shares such an adventure in his catalog description. I bought this painting by Frank Schoonover in 1974 at the Little Nemo shop, which specialized in comic strip art, pulps, illustration, and the like. Opened in 1969, the shop, the first of its type in New York, was named in honor of Winsor McCay's early comic strip character. About to leave, I spotted this painting. It was filthy, covered with grime, a real mess. We took a rag and wiped the surface, revealing first Schoonover's signature, and then the boat's transom. Checking the reverse side of the painting, I saw numbers on the stretcher. I knew that Frank Schoonover had kept meticulous records in his diaries, which resided at the Delaware Art Museum. I left the shop, found a payphone beside the expressway, no cell phones then, and called the museum. Finally managed to get through to an assistant, but as it was late in the day, not able to get a confirmation that the stretcher number was Schoonover's. Informed that the museum had given a copy of the diaries to the newly founded Brandywine River Museum, I called them, and they confirmed that the number matched Schoonover's cast adrift. Returning to the Little Nemo shop, I bought the picture, probably paid twice what it was worth, but it would be a bargain today. And more importantly, it's a work that I'll keep until I die. Andrew Sordoni has built and refined a collection of illustration and comic art over more than 50 years, and he is very pleased to share well over 100 works in this show at Wilkes University. The exhibit has been curated by Dr. Stanley I. Grand and is accompanied by a substantial catalog featuring well-known artists and illustrators like Norman Rockwell, Howard Pyle, Charles Schulz, Al Hirschfeld, Al Capp, Charles Adams, and many others whose pieces are in the Sordoni Gallery show. Andrew J. Sordoni III and Dr. Stanley Grand paid a visit to the WVIA studios with Heather Sienkiewicz, director of the Sordoni Gallery, to talk with us about the collection and its roots. Andrew Sordoni.
My first recollection is in the late 1940s. And I can tell because I know what the images were. It was Sunday comic pages in what we called the funny papers, the color supplements that came out on Sundays. And they were in the Sunday Independent and other newspapers that we saw. And I remember the adventure strips and particularly the characters who never were, whether it was the Phantom or Tarzan or Mandrake the Magician. But my favorite character of all was Dick Tracy.
What did he do for you? Open up the sense of the future?
A feeling of fiction, a sense of adventure, a lack of the present reality, and a whole lot of fantasy.
And yet we could identify with somebody like Dick Tracy in his hat rather than maybe the Phantom in his getup.
Well, I think I identified with all of them in different ways, but immediately then the comic strips or the funny papers, as we call them, led me to the illustrated classics. And the first image I remember was from Treasure Island. It was Captain Bill Bones and the N.C. Wyeth rendering. And 20 years later, I guess I saw the painting for the first time at the Brandywine River Museum, and it was absolutely breathtaking.
And there are these masters whose images are indelible, like N.C. Wyeth. I'm sure you can still call those images to mind right now.
Oh, absolutely. And it started, you know, at King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, moved down into London with Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, then jumped the Atlantic, and we had Hopalong Cassidy, the Lone Ranger, and Batman and Robin. I mean, all of those characters were very vivid to me as a young lad in school.
And so it was both the stories and the remarkable illustrations, the whole package.
Well, it all merged to me because I saw motion pictures, particularly B-grade Westerns, serials, and those little series pictures that were shown in double features in our neighborhood in the early 50s. And so it was an indivisible connection between the moving image and then the still image. And we began to tell pretty early which illustrators, which animators were the good ones that we could follow easily and that were fluid, and then which ones were static or stodgy.
And so you were developing an eye without even an eye to collecting.
Oh, it certainly was an amateur eye. It wasn't a practiced eye.
You knew the difference.
You began to feel the difference. And whether you know the difference is very hard to say, but if you feel the difference, and for me, art was almost always visceral rather than cerebral.
Now, you had a household that appreciated the visual arts especially.
Yes, and we had a household that appreciated the moving image as well, and it tolerated the lowbrow comic books, comic strips, and all of the other things that were part of the popular culture in those days.
Were you sharing these images with your schoolmates? Did you talk about the stories and show each other what you were reading?
The only schoolmate that I recall sharing with a lot was your colleague, Bob Salzberg, who was the first person I remember in grade school who introduced me to Mad Magazine and the great satire. But that was almost 6 or 7 years after I'd become exposed to the other characters.
And your sense about art was partly influenced by your mother, who was an artist.
My mother always knew the difference between good drafting and less than good drafting, and she would point it out whenever we saw almost any image, whether it were an advertisement, a billboard, or just a magazine illustration. And you begin quickly to pay attention, first to the hands, then to the limbs, and then to the face and the features. As you begin to do that, you can quickly separate the good images from the not-so-good images.
There were also then those advertising images that were another aspect of the illustrator's art.
Well, you love the macho stuff. Much later, the macho things would be characters like the Marlboro Man. But before that, there were even the pretty girls dancing in a old gold cigarette cartons, a king size and a regular size. So you had glamour art, you had a bit of adventure, you had celebrity, because there would be caricatures of various celebrities, and then there were cartoons. And by cartoons, I mean animated cartoons. But from as far back as I can remember, I also loved humor cartoons, loved gags, loved to laugh.
Dr. Grant, when you and Mr. Sordoni came together very first time, this was not your beat.
That is very true. My background is quite different. I would say that whereas Andrew came to art from a visceral point of view, I came to it more from an intellectual point of view. I was not an art history major in my undergraduates. I majored in history and intellectual philosophy. But at a certain point in the 80s, I became more and more interested in the visual arts as a result of both friends and also trips to Europe. But I was always very interested in iconography, which in plain English is picture writing. And I was very interested in the stories, the meaning, the content, and then gradually became more appreciative of the technique and materials and composition and all of those aspects. But I think I really came to it from a different direction, and this has been a tremendous experience for me personally because it is a whole area that I knew nothing about. And it is an area that maybe as a younger person, I might have been very condescending toward. Andrew calls this lowbrow, and I was more interested in the highbrow, either the classical antiquities, classical art, or Renaissance art, or the continuation of those traditions into the 20th, 21st century. So it's been a real learning experience for me. Andrew is an autodidact in this area. He's taught himself. He has made a commitment to the art, both in terms of his eye and his pocketbook and his contacts, and has really been a great instructor to me. We've been working on this project now for about 2 years, and he has been diligently trying to bring me up to speed.
What is it that you would want somebody like Dr. Grand to know and us to know about this collection? You're attracted to things that speak to you. Is that right?
I suspect that I had multiple motivations. You're never really quite sure because each acquisition, each little love that you develop for that piece happens separately. It happens in the context of that moment. But one thing I knew from the very beginning is that the intellectual world looked down on American art. And I heard from both my mother and my father that American art was valid in its own right. So I would have known early that Eastman Johnson and Winslow Homer and George DeForest Brush and people like that were really significant painters. That led me to open my mind and really open my collection to the lowbrow stuff that I love so much and include it. And it is, this is an inclusive collection because there are some pieces that are not really well done, but they're outstanding for some reason. They have some spark of inspiration, some bit of je ne sais quoi, and that's it.
Take us to that first moment. Was it a pivotal moment when you made the first investment?
The first piece that I bought because I knew it was a recognized artist. It was a Maxfield Parrish. It was about 1960. I borrowed the money from my father. For me, it was a significant investment at the time, probably less than $200 or thereabout. But it still, that was significant for me. But I knew it was important. I used that piece a few years later to trade for something that I wanted that was less prestigious as far as the signature, but more significant in terms of the composition and the rendering and so on. And so that was the way you begin to build. Probably a full 20% of the collection was acquired through barter. And there were pieces that I never could have bought for money, but I could trade for something that the other collector wanted. And so you maintained a certain amount of inventory and you understood that many things in your collection were fungible, so to speak. And I always knew that if I were imprisoned or in a one-room flat somewhere and I only had one image, I always knew which one it would be.
Well, you can't not tell us.
Well, today it would probably be my Crazy Cat Sunday page because it has all of the characters and all of the vitality of those of the wonderful cat and Ignatz Mouse. But it changes. You can be fickle with it too, Erica.
And yet you do still have Maxfield Parrish in the collection.
Yes. I've gone through probably 8 or 9 Maxfield Parrish paintings, in addition to the little drawing that I started with. And I've traded down to all but 3. 2 I acquired, and 1, which is the only thing in my collection, that passed down to me from my mother. She got it as a gift from my grandfather. Her father-in-law didn't like American art, but he bought it in a grouping of pictures in a deal someplace, and so he gave it to her, and she treasured it, and I acquired it from her estate.
Dr. Grant, tell us, please, about this particular image by Maxfield Parrish and why it's such a right one for the invitation and notice of the show.
Well, this is an image. It's called The Dark Futurist, and it is a painter who is seated on a stool. It seems like a very iconic kind of an image. There's no background, so you're focused on just the figure who is holding a paintbrush in one hand and a palette in the other. And he has these wonderful round glasses, and he is very frontal, just kind of there, almost like a Byzantine type icon. You have that very linear outline. The outline is very, very important. So it is a very confrontational picture. It is one that celebrates art. It is also, as David Apatow, who is the art critic for the Saturday Evening Post, mentioned in his essay on this painting, it does reference the Italian Futurist movement from the teens, the early 1910, 1915. Most of the Futurists, as you know, believed that society should be dragged down to be rebuilt, kind of like a phoenix. They were very enthusiastic about the coming of the First World War. And, of course, most of them were killed in that war, which sort of put an end to the movement in many ways. So I think that it's a significant picture. It is paired with another Maxfield Parrish that shows a fellow painting a billboard. The billboard says Life for Life magazine. It's a cover for Life magazine. And so you have kind of a balance of one, the dark futurist, and the other, which is called A Man of Letters, but also it's called Mudball because some street urchin has thrown a mudball at the sign painter as he's doing that. So I think they're both strong images. They are very legible. You look at them and you understand what the point is immediately. And they make that kind of, you know, to the stomach, visceral kind of impact.
We are able to see this collection because of the generosity of your family, the Sordoni family, and your mother again coming into play and founding the gallery. And just recently, we all as a community and a university came together to celebrate the reopening of this very special gallery. And Heather Sienkiewicz, you are the director of this gallery. What does the pairing of a collection like this mean for the institution and the gallery in this first year?
I think it's important that, number one, Wilkes University is showing that it has a renewed commitment to the arts. The gallery is 45 years old, so it is something that has been around a while, but, you know, the activity in the gallery has ebbed and flowed over the years. And what is lovely about being here and being at the helm, I guess, of the gallery itself is that I'm a part of administration that really has made this a central focus to the mission of the university, where arts are really the foundation to the course of study at Wilkes. So I'm thrilled to be part of that and also to kind of honor the long legacy of the Sordoni family of illustration, because we have done, you know, iconic exhibitions in comic arts before they were really being done. Now being able to look at this exhibition and look at the collection in such a grand scheme, it's a very exciting time for Wilkes.
Take us to Hopalong Cassidy. What has he meant to you? How did he grab you?
I came to Hopalong Cassidy through the movies, home movies. We had 16-millimeter movies at home, showed them for our family and for neighborhood kids almost on a weekly basis. And of all of the Westerns, the good guys and the bad guys, Hopalong Cassidy really stood out. And the reason they stood out is that those pictures had greater production value, greater legitimate actors and actresses, and incredible photography and scenery. And so we were drawn to them. Later, quickly, we knew about Hopalong Cassidy through television, through comic books, comic strips, Sunday pages, and also discovered that great artists like N.C. Wyeth, whom we knew about, Frank Schoonover, whom we knew about, and others, had painted these pictures for the original books as conceived by Clarence E. Mulford. So it was just a real love affair from the beginning. And I continued to collect the films. And until the television era and the era of DVDs, I showed them regularly to my kids and to guests who were interested in that kind of entertainment, B-grade entertainment from the 30s and 40s.
You just mentioned N.C. Wyeth. Let's bring Frank Schoonover to the forefront because he had ties to our region as well.
Schoonover was not a native in northeastern Pennsylvania, but he spent many, many happy decades in the Delaware Water Gap area. And early in his career, I mean, right after the turn of the 20th century, he did a series of wonderful commissions in Scranton of the silk mills and of people associated with the child labor in the mines. That was some of his strongest and best social commentary. Later, he did easel paintings in the Delaware Water Gap, and we were privileged here at WVIA to put together a production called The Authentic Artist, which was Frank E. Schoonover. So he is indelibly tied here, but also in this exhibition, I point out that there are some other Pennsylvania-centric artists and particularly some local roots. Two colorful characters, Rose O'Neill and Ham Fisher, were both born in Wilkes-Barre. The prolific artist, pulp artist, Rudolph Belarski, was born in Duryea. others that are not in the exhibition but whose work I revere are the Savitz brothers, who became professionally known as Savitt, particularly Sam and then Alfie Savitt. They were from the Heights section of Wilkes-Barre. And there are so many wonderful painters in the collection that came from Philadelphia and environs.
Heather, you alluded to the fact that the Sordoni Gallery has, in fact, shown these images before they might have been more noticed in the world at large. What is the status now of this kind of work mm-hmm. in the art world? Mm-hmm.
I think it's becoming far more respected. We're seeing more museums open up dedicated to illustration. We see major collectors such as George Lucas really coming forward and making a big commitment to the medium as well, and bringing it to the forefront for everyone to really enjoy. I think there's something to be said of these artists, or the artists that were making work that essentially was tossed away. It's funny that as I've gotten in to actually see the work, spend some time with the work, you see such amazing craftsmanship that I can't even imagine that it would have been tossed or tossed aside. So the fact that we are really honoring these artists for artists, not just paid consultants, I guess, if you want to put it that way.
And you know, Erica, Heather's comment is right on target. Some of this is very high craft. And for years, maybe even for a couple of generations, it was put down because of the craft elements. We see it as art, but not all of anything is art any more than all of anything is craft, and the lines are blurred.
One of the things that I'd like to bring us back to again is the personal roots, and it's a lovely inclusion that there is a cartoon that your mother did.
Well, she did very few cartoons in her life, but she was a spontaneous artist. In the late 1930s, she did the daily rushes for Marshall Field Department Store and did a lot of the fashion illustration. She was the coordinator, and she was very fast with charcoal or pen and ink or pencil. And unfortunately, all of her work from that era is lost. But in the 1950s, she became enamored particularly of the cartoonist in the New Yorker, Charles Adams. And she did a series of posters for Halloween, and she did a series of theme parties for kids with the Charles Adams characters long before they were popular on television. And this particular one is part of American popular culture because it celebrates Halloween and the phenomenon of Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier.
Dr. Grand, you pointed out that there is no caption for that. And what did you do in light of that?
Well, I made a note in the catalog because the cartoon has three characters. They're all ghosts. And two of them are parental ghosts, and one is an adolescent ghost wearing a coonskin cap. The fact of the matter is that in 1955, 1956, Walt Disney did Davy Crockett on Frontierland, and it was a huge mass fad. And every kid, every boy of 11, 12, 10, wanted a coonskin hat. And so this cartoon shows this little boy with a coonskin hat. But the interesting thing is, when I've asked younger people, say under 40, what does this cartoon mean to you? It kind of draws a blank. And to me, that is symptomatic of the evolving nature of popular culture, that what is the lingua franca of one generation quickly becomes obscure as time goes on. And the example I gave earlier when we were chatting is when Dante wrote the Divine Comedy at the beginning of the 4th century, everybody knew who the bums were that he put into hell. And today, you need to look at the footnotes because none of the names means anything to anybody. And that's kind of what happens with the evolution of popular culture.
And Heather, just one more thing about the opening season of this gallery. You just had a very powerful show with an artist from the Lehigh Valley whose images were exploring the feminine and questions of gender. And here we see images of women of a certain period and the men in their lives and men separately. And you mentioned the macho Marlboro man. What do we see in these images?
As far as with some of the images of women, we do see women in a pensive nature, you know, really kind of evaluating. There's one piece that I am thinking about in particular where it's a profile of a woman who's sitting there with scissors, and it's a question of, is she going to cut her dress to be a bit shorter to keep on trend? And I find that to be really great because it's women thinking about how they are perceived and how they want to be perceived. And with that piece, it was like, oh, yes, you know, we're finally being seen as thinking women, women who want to be in control of our image. So I adore that piece. It was one of those things where I was like, this is wonderful to see as hemlines were raising. Is this something that we really want? We see women throughout the exhibition in that nature of pensive, in that nature of contemplative, like really kind of evaluating who they are. And then we see women having fun. We see women that are in control of their sexuality and are completely comfortable in their own skin. So it's great to see it as well.
Dr. Grand wasn't telling tales out of school, but I was curious, and I think people are curious about where this collection is when it's not being displayed at the Sordoni Gallery. And Dr. Grand, what did you tell us?
Well, I said that this is a collection that Andrew and his family lives with. It is not a collection that's in a vault, or it is not a collection that was put together as an investment, but it's a collection that is lived with. It is a collection that is seen in the morning light, in the evening light, in moods when you're happy, when there's tension. And it's a part of his life. His office is covered with art. And it's clear that this is somebody for whom art is very important and is a part of his life rather than as an object to be venerated or to be kept in a separate museum. And I know initially when we first started talking about doing this exhibition, one of the negotiations was the amount of time that you would be without your art.
Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. But one thing about this collection and that we live with, we rotate pieces. Some pieces have stayed maybe for as long as 10 years in a given spot. But on average, the pieces are rotated as the mood strikes or as you fall in or out of love a little more with a given piece. I can also say that at any given time, we often have one or more pieces on loan for exhibition elsewhere because although we don't share extensively, sharing is a huge impulse. You can't fully enjoy art alone. You need to share and to understand what another human sees in it.
And so that's in essence what's happening here with this show. You are sharing these images with us so that we'll be surprised and delighted and make connections on our own.
Exactly.
Again, it goes beyond nostalgia, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, maybe following up on one thing that Heather said, we are looking at a period of a little over 100 years, and there have been tremendous changes in the way both women, for example, are perceived, but also how they perceive themselves, how they present themselves. There are also real changes in terms of racial views, and some of the earlier cartoons would be considered very politically incorrect because of stereotypes that are used in the drawing, for example. But it's important for us to understand our own history and the subliminal messages that we get that maybe affect our attitudes in terms of other people and our views of, say, minorities or different religions or this or that. So I think that it really presents an interesting timeline of our kind of American culture. And if I might add something, this is a very large exhibition. It's over 130 works. And it is an exhibition that is not a once and done. You can go back numerous times and you will see different things, and you can think about different works.
Just for the record, the gallery exists on South Main Street, or has been recreated on South Main Street in Wilkes-Barre, the site of the former Bartakowski jewelry store. And Max Bartakowski, the son of the founder, is a character, a recurring character, in the Joe Palooka comic strip as created by Wilkes-Barre native Ham Fisher.
Little Max?
Little Max is Max Bartakowski. A great person, a personality in Wilkes-Barre and in all of America.
Yes! Andrew J. Sordoni III, collector. Dr. Stanley I. Grand, curator, and Heatherson Cavage, director of the Sordoni Art Gallery at Wilkes University, speaking with us about the exhibit, Selections from the Sordoni Collection of American Illustration and Comic Art, that will run at the Sordoni Art Gallery to May 20th, drawn from the private collection of Andrew J. Sordoni III. The exhibition features 135 original artworks by more than 100 artists, including Golden Age illustrators N.C. Wyeth, Maxfield Parrish, and Frank Schoonover. Norman Rockwell is also represented. Subject matter varies from adventure to courtship to westerns, pulps, and glamour, and provides a glimpse into the popular culture and interests from the late 19th century to the present. The exhibition includes paintings and drawings that appeared on magazine covers, interior story illustrations, ads, book jackets, album covers, daily and Sunday comic strips, cartoons, and movie sells. The show will open with a reception tomorrow. That's Saturday, April 7th, and it's at 4:30, free and open to the public. In addition, the gallery is hosting an afternoon lecture series on Wednesdays at 4:30 at the Art Gallery, 141 South Main Street. They are free and open to the public. The first is Wednesday, April 11th. It's a curator's tour with Dr. Grand. April 25th, What Makes a Pulp Different from a Slick? And that will be presented by David Saunders, illustration historian and son of Norman Saunders, who is featured in the exhibition. And then also May 2nd at 4:30, The Solitary Figure in American Illustration, and that will be presented by Andrew J. Sordoni III. For more information on the web, wilkes.edu/Sordoni Art Gallery. Sordoni Art Gallery is S-O-R-D-O-N-I, so it's wilkes.edu/Sordoni Art Gallery. Selections from the Sordoni Collection of American Illustration and Comic Art from April 7th to May 20th. And for more information on the web, wilkes.edu/Sordoni Art Gallery. And again, you're invited to attend the reception, the opening reception, tomorrow beginning at 4:30. And that's at the gallery, 141 South Main Street in downtown Wilkes-Barre. And for more information on the web, wilkes.edu/Sordoni Art Gallery.